Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we're taking a trip to Nebraska in a used car.
Hey, I'm from that part of the country. Let me give you a piece of advice.
Okay, what's that?
Watch out for that highway patrolman.
Okay, what are we drinking here today, Mike?
I have just poured you a Broad Street IPA from the Mad Fox Brewing Company in Falls Church, Virginia. You know, it's not one of those citrusy, hazy beers. I mean, it's a slightly darker than amber, traditional IPA.
So okay.
You get a little bit. You get
tastes
a little
great.
Bit bitterness. You get some malt, and you get a little bit of sweetness in there at the end. You might maybe toffee. Maybe, I don't know, caramel?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mad Fox, that's your local brewery that you like to...
Yeah, it's about 4 miles.
To patronize. Yep.
Yeah. Right in the middle of Falls Church on Broad Street.
So. Do they bottle anything, or it's all just growlers that you get?
They do some occasional bottling. They haven't done any for a while, but they often bottle their barley wines, and they do some aging in some, you know, whiskey barrels. And they may bottle those once in a while.
Okay.
But they haven't done a bottle for a while.
Yeah, half price growler fills on Tuesday is
exactly.
The key about Mad Fox.
Yep,
so you want to go and have one
all
at the
right.
bar while they're filling your growler and cleaning it out for you. Or like me, they yell at me for not taking care of it properly.
Is that right?
Well, yes, I've been chewed out. Actually, last time I was there, they gave me a little slip showing me how to clean my growler when it was empty. We'd like you to do this. You know, you're supposed to wash it out, air dry, and do a couple things, but I tend to forget, and I leave the top on, you know, because I'm passed out or laying on the ground drinking my growler.
Yeah.
Well, here's a good tip. If you're going to take your growler to the brewery, take the lid off and smell it. And if it smells like mold or vinegar or something,
funky.
You probably ought to wash it.
Yeah, you should wash it out.
But okay, so we're 3 minutes in.
Okay.
Springsteen talk.
Here? Oh, that's right.
No, it's good. I enjoy this, but this is Rockin' the Suburbs, and we do rock the suburbs by drinking beer and supporting our local breweries.
Yes, we do.
And we would encourage everyone to do that.
Absolutely.
But we also listen to a lot of music,
mm-hmm.
and that's really what the show is about.
It is.
And I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us all week are...
Mike Snyder.
And intern Sam.
Sam Lisker. Thank you, guys, for being on this. And we've been talking about a different Springsteen album all this week. We hit on Born to Run, Darkness on the Edge of Town, The River, and now we are up to Nebraska. A very different record.
Saw her standing on her front lawn, just a twirling her baton. Me and her went for a ride in ten innocent people died. From the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my lap, through the badlands of Wyoming, I killed everything in my path.
Patrick. Did you get into this record at the time?
It
would have been 1982.
I did buy this record. I remember buying it. At the time, I was dating a girl. Believe it or not, Bruce had helped me along far enough that I actually got a few to talk to me. So I actually had a semi-regular girlfriend. And I remember he was a music fan, and he said... I'll tell you what, you know, I heard this Nebraska album is real different. How about you and I split it and we'll listen to it and we can each, you know, I'll tape it and you can keep the vinyl. And I said, sure, you know, great. I remember going to Kent Mill Records in Falls Church and buying Nebraska on the day or the, you know, right around the time it came out. And it was difficult, you know, coming off the high of the River Tour, branding myself as a big Springsteen fan, suddenly to be presented with a stark set of demos that were recorded on, you know, a cassette player. Bruce apparently carried the cassette around in his pocket, you know, for a long time. And basically, to prepare for these episodes, these five, I got to tell you, as I mentioned earlier, I had, with my wife, we had gone, you know, about 2 hours away from where we live to a wedding this weekend. And we listened to The River. We listened to Born in the USA. We listened to Born to Run, you know, while we were driving around in the car. We didn't listen to Darkness. And I purposefully, she did not want to listen to Nebraska. And I purposely saved this one for last night so I could listen to it at home on headphones and really kind of get into that vibe. And what I wrote is either terrible or accurate. I don't know, but they are they are my feelings. I said this record reminds me of a combination of Truman Capote and Chuck Berry. It's overcome with a sense of dread and desperation. Are these the best demos of all time? And then what I feel like probably encapsulates my feelings best. These are like the charcoal sketches of a master painter studies for a portrait that in some cases were fleshed out, but in many cases were not. They're stark, they're moving, they're telling. And I don't, you know, in all honesty, I don't think it was until the 2000s when I really began to deeply appreciate how great Nebraska was. At the time, it was unsettling. It wasn't the way I thought Bruce should be. And, you know, I listened to it and I put it on the shelf, to be honest. And
yeah,
and I didn't really engage with it a whole lot. I do have a tremendous affection now for almost every single song on the record, but it took a long time for me to get to that place. And it was, I think, very, very influential, extremely influential for the Americana movement, for a lot of singer-songwriters, and also an incredibly brave artistic statement for somebody who was at the top of his game and put out this incredibly, you know, big hit single with Hungry Heart, and finally he's going to be that, right, you know, this blockbuster guy. And then I can't imagine what the people at CBS thought when he first said, this is what I want to put out next.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it really, I don't know, it doesn't make any sense when you think about it from a commercial standpoint. No. So here, like you said, double album that people felt came the closest to like the live E Street Band experience and all of that, and then complete opposite direction. Like, this is bedroom recordings essentially, exactly, right? You know what they call now demos, at the time when you didn't have all the technology that we have today to do, you know, pretty well produced demos, right, even, right? So
right,
so on a 4-track recorder, and was not intended to be released in this format, but right, but it was, because apparently the songs just weren't working with the band or something like that. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, these songs were so different, I think, to a large extent from what he had done before, that it felt like it should be a solo record. And it felt like he did it so well on the demos, like, let's put that out. But it's almost unprecedented.
It really
I mean, there may be other examples of stuff like this. Maybe Dylan did stuff like this. I don't know. But
I don't think he ever took left turn this hard.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. It's, and you know, Bruce was listening to Suicide, the band, and he was reading In Cold Blood by Truman Capote and was moved by that. And these songs are, there's very little light in them. Occasionally there's a glimpse of hope, but, you know, right off the bat, you know, you get a song about a killing spree.
Yeah.
And it goes down from there. In some cases it gets darker.
But I think for a big commercial artist, this is about the closest you're going to get to, like, the true artist.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me, I mean, there are times when Neil Young takes turns.
Okay, that's
like
a good one.
That's a great point,
that's
Mike.
A good example.
And it helps great if you're point. A Neil Young fan to deal with something like this. According to Bruce's book, they were thinking of doing another double album where they do Born in the USA as electric and this as acoustic. Mm-hmm. I actually think this worked better. I'm like you, Patrick, in that I didn't originally embrace this thing, right, but I think you really have to be in the mood listen to something like this. But there are times when, especially something you guys do well, is to let people know we're not in a music desert right now. And every once in a while, I'll go back to some of these songs to just remind me that, you know, there is still great music that could be made. Not necessarily, you know, this isn't new or anything, but it's out there, and I can still listen to it. Jamie mentioned bedtime stories. That's interesting because he said he wanted to make these like bedtime stories. He said kind of like John Lee Hooker and Robert Johnson.
Wow.
He said, I wanted the listener to hear my characters think, to feel their thoughts, their choices. These songs were the opposite of the rock music I'd been writing. And so you're in the mind of a serial killer.
Right.
He's not really. I mean, he's a bad person. I don't know if you'd call him necessarily a serial killer like Dexter. But then these other people, they're just you're really getting taken to some other places here.
Oh, yeah. It has that sort of outlaw country.
Absolutely.
Feeling to mm-hmm. it, right?
Yep, totally.
You're writing about some of the most desperate, depraved, you know, characters, right? But in a way that gives it a, I don't know if this is the right word exactly, but there's a certain romanticism to it.
Yeah,
to,
without a
to
doubt.
It in a way.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do feel like he, you know, recasts a lot of Chuck Berry's America in absolutely a reverse image, you know, the negative of it. Whereas The Highway and you know, there was always positivity in a lot of Chuck Berry songs, and it was still big America. This is the different side, the underbelly, the opposite, the reverse psych. But
yeah,
I don't know. I'm interested, Sam, how did it strike you, you know, listening to it as obviously, you know, somebody wasn't alive when it came out and you didn't understand, you know, I mean, in some ways, it could be career suicide. Like, this guy had worked this hard to get to this place, right. And suddenly he's going to, like, he could have alienated all of his fans. But what were your impressions of it?
Well, straight off, I knew nothing about this album going in to listen to it. I didn't really look up the backstory before listening to it. So a lot of it really took me by surprise. When I saw Nebraska and I saw the album art, I thought this was going to have maybe some country vibe to it or some sort of Midwest vibe, because my mom grew up in Nebraska for a short period of time.
Oh, okay.
And she has a lot of stories from the time of her life, but it almost reminds me when she tells me these stories of this desolate place, and I think the album art perfectly captures that. I know how much you love the album art, so we'll touch on that in a few minutes. But just wow, these were sad tracks right off the bat. The first track about the man and his girlfriend, that it was a 20-year-old man and his 14-year-old girlfriend or something that went on just a killing spree just for the hell of it, and then he gets caught and then he gets executed. I mean, it's just wow. I'm like, this is only the first track.
Yeah.
So it's just listening to it, I wasn't expecting to get this raw Springsteen sound, but I think the fact that they're from demos and they're not from what were originally supposed to be just demos and just were put on an album like this, I think really make it also special in a way. But the one question, and this is for all three of you, the one question I was left with at the end of this record was, does Springsteen want us to feel some sort of emotional bond with the killers that he's portraying in this? Because I sort of feel not right feeling that way, because he really does make it sound sad and almost make you feel for what they did. I don't know. It's really tough for me to put.
No, you're right. You are supposed to feel something for these as humans, right? You're not supposed to agree with the choices they made in life, but you're supposed to empathize with them in some way, I think, right? And they become sort of anti-heroes in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it's that sort of idea of like, you know, putting yourself, trying to see the world through their eyes, as difficult as that may be, and as how kind of scary or, you know, as frightening as that may be, but what would that be like? Like what's their inner sort of feelings and struggles and, you know, I don't know. It's a dark place to go. It's in a way, you know, there's elements of this that can be darker than Darkness on the Edge of Town for sure.
Absolutely.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yet at the same time, there's something about the production of it, because it was like demos, that maybe takes some of the edge off.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if you had made if you'd gone in the studio, I think, and really like produced this to be a dark record, I think maybe it might be too much. Right.
Exactly.
But the idea of like, just like, it's almost like kind of a campfire song in a way. It's like a guy and his guitar singing, and that tradition of men in black hats, you know, goes back a long way in terms of
absolutely.
You know, country music and folk music and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, a lot of what you're getting here. There's a certain Johnny Cashness to this album too, with some of the rockabilly bits, and the Johnny was one of those guys who would sing about people who, you know, like, you know, who were Outlaws and,
yeah,
and
that's right.
You know, Folsom Prison Blues, mm-hmm. you know, and shot a man in Reno just to watch him die, right? Yeah. You know, he was the kind of guy who would go to those dark places in his songwriting. And I think, you know, Bruce was looking at, how do I explore a totally different aspect of America and this American journey that we're on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, you know, I know this now from doing research and learning about the record, that Bruce was reading a lot of Flannery O'Connor, who in her writing did very much kind of the same thing. It was dark, and she wanted you to understand that these people are human beings and that people get to these places and these things sort of happen. And this is the way people think. And, you know, one song that always really strikes me on this record is Highway Patrolman, where, you know, the brother of the police officer is constantly in trouble. And at the end of the song, he pulls over to the side of the road after chasing his brother who's committed a crime or perhaps killed somebody, and just watches him drive across the state line. So it's no longer his responsibility. And, you know, the line is, a man turns his back on his family, he just ain't no good. So these people have ethos, but they may be twisted and they may not be mm-hmm. what we have, but they do have ethos. And I think in one way, that's what he's trying to show, that for them, they're doing what they think is what's supposed to be done because that's what they believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it's heavy stuff.
It is. You
know, this is a little different from, you know, I got some beer and the highway's
that's
free.
Right.
you got me. Yeah.
There's a slightly yeah. lighter song with Used Cars. I always identified with this because, you know, when you're in a blue collar community, you don't often buy a new car,
right?
You know, and this is obviously a kid watching their family make a big deal about getting the used car, and the neighbors come to see the used car, and he's like,
yep.
This is BS, man. When I grow up, we're not going to ride in a used car again. I mean, and those are, I mean, that's just a feeling that I remember as a kid, you know, and it's like, oh God, I gotta get the used car.
Right.
It's like, I gotta elevate my game.
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to be me making that choice. And I think, you know, another one that's, for me personally, Atlantic City is a song that it's a tremendous song. And it's actually the first song that I ever learned to play on guitar by Bruce Springsteen, because it's, you know, it's kind of a repetitive strumming pattern, and E minor and A minor and a G and a C, and it's pretty easy to play, but it also has this really cool, you know, like vocal thing, and you know, it's pretty awesome when you actually get inside of a song like that and you actually learn, even though it's, you know, 6 to 8 chords or whatever it is, to sing it, and you know, you really feel that story. But man, another classic case of Bruce's writing, like the first lines in this song, they blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night. I mean, that's a great unbelievable line. Like Marat based a lot of their career on just that line right there. You know, it's like an amazing opening line.
That song has definitely stood the test of time.
Oh,
I mean, you
doubt.
Hear people cover that song.
Yes.
It's out there. It's become really big in his catalog, I think, for a lot of other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that chorus, just tremendous. Everything dies, baby. That's a fact.
Right.
But everything that dies one day comes right. back. Yeah. It's tremendous.
It was his first video. I don't think he's even in the video.
I think it was
just a black and white video
of
driving around Atlantic City.
But I remember seeing it a lot.
Yeah.
In the early days of MTV, it was on a lot. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good song.
It's definitely a story of, you know, people that live. This resonates today. It's people that live paycheck to paycheck, and definitely resonate mm-hmm. with this story. You know, mm-hmm.
well,
and there's a certain, like, even though it hit that weightiness, that whole, you know, everything dies, that's a fact. But then still, there's like,
fix your hair up pretty.
Put you on your dress, fix your hair pretty, because we're going to Atlantic City,
right?
You know,
even though bright lights,
like that doesn't sound. Like there's a certain desperation in that, even right. Still, it's like we're not
going to Vegas, but we're going to
that's right,
Atlantic.
That's right. But maybe there'll be a big score. Maybe something will happen, right? You know. So you mentioned the band Suicide. Talk a little bit about that, because that was really influencing Bruce in this period.
Yeah,
he was going to dark places himself.
Yeah, absolutely, and obviously, one of the darkest. There's a song by Suicide's pretty well known called Frankie Teardrop, where in that song, you know, it's pretty horrifying song where Frankie Teardrop ends up shooting his child in the crib. But that, you know, Bruce was fascinated by the minimalism that they put together with just Martin Vega's vocals and, you know, a drum machine. And it was very confrontational and super, super stark. And that was a big influence on him. And I also want to point out, I don't know Jim or Sam or Mike, if you guys know that in 2000, Sub Pop Records issued a compilation called Badlands, a tribute to Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska, talking about tributes. And some of the people on here, it's very interesting. I mean, Chrissy Hynde and Adam Seymour cover Nebraska, but you have people like Sunvolt, Ben Harper, Los Lobos, Star Williams, Deanna Carter,
wow,
Ani DeFranco. And so this record did influence a whole, generation of sort of alt country and singer-songwriters that were, dark and went to that certain place. And what I think is really interesting about that is not only that the music was stark and moving and incredible, but it showed the bravery of an artist. I mean, back in 1982, I didn't know major label from indie label. Like, I just wanted to hear Springsteen and drive around and drink beer with my friends. But now when you look back on it, you learn more about it, what a brave decision it was for a major label artist to take that risk and stand up for himself. And I think, for a lot of people, it really was, an inspirational move, and they found ways in their careers to make very difficult choices and stand by them. So that's, I think, another legacy of this record.
Well, the other thing it did, it helped prepare his fans for things that are going to come in his career. I mean,
that's a great point, Mike.
And it gave him a chance. Like, this song isn't an E Street Band song. This is a This is a song I produce with other musicians, or this is a song I do pretty stark
just on my own.
Yeah, that's
Ghost
right.
Ghost of Tom Joad's going to come up down the road. Devils and Dust to a little lesser extent. The Pete Seeger sessions are a couple different. I mean, that's played with a band, but it's folk stuff, you know? Yep. So it's like, this prepared people for those kind of turns.
So I want to get back real quickly to the song that people compare most to the band Suicide is State Trooper.
That's right.
Right? Because just sonically, it sounds like it. But we talked earlier about Springsteen and like the cinematic sense of a lot of his songs. And when you think of like some of the best movies in terms of tension, whether it's like Hitchcock or even up to today, like the Coen brothers, right? They tend to be about like desperate people. Desperate people are what make for a great movie, because that's when they do things maybe out of character, out of circumstance, out of just need, whatever. That's like how they act the most rash, right?
Yep.
And in this song, like the thing I love about this song is like there's this super quiet tension in this song, right? When it gets that part where it's like, Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me. Like that, it feels like that's a movie, right? There's a guy sitting there driving, and everybody's, been to a lesser extent with that feeling of like a police car, behind you.
Always.
And is he going to pull me over for speeding or whatever? But in this case, there's something way worse that could happen if he gets pulled over, right? And that, oh my God, there is such tension in that song.
Totally agree. I mean, it is an incredible example of that. And that's part of the masterpiece, the artistry of this record is the ability to just take a voice and acoustic guitar, maybe a little smear of harmonica here and there, but to be able to do that is really incredible.
Okay. It was a bold move.
Yeah.
We all agree on that.
Absolutely.
I think, though, it's a good lesson for a lot of artists, which is that feeling of like, when you have something, when you put out something that's a big hit, sometimes it's a great career move to then go in a totally different direction, right? Because if you're trying to just always top that latest hit with like more of the same, people are either going to, you can't do it, or people get bored with it or whatever, right? But to take your fans on a, down a different road is what makes for a career. You mentioned a guy like Neil Young, perfect example
great
of that
example.
As well. Yeah. So this is Springsteen basically establishing himself again, reestablishing himself in some way as a true artist, right? Like, I'm going to have a lasting, meaningful career here.
Yeah. And, I think it's interesting that the record ends with Reason to Believe. I mean, there is all this darkness that he throws at you, and all this death and all this murder and all this, what we think of as twisted thinking. Yet even that song has a weird kind of, morbidity to it, right? The first line, in man standing on the side of the road, he's poking a dead dog with a stick or whatever. But at the end of the day, we all find a reason to believe, and we don't know exactly why we do, but we do. And it's kind of cool that's hopeful. And I always remember when I first got this record to be like, all right, well, it's not all bad. There is a reason to believe, and that's kind of stuck on the end there. So, again, some great lines on this record, man. I mean, he, you know, a writer for our times. But, you know, to be completely honest, in 1982, like Mike said, it's not really what I wanted. You know, I had it. I was down with it. But yeah. I was, you know, that's not the Bruce that I wanted in,
it was,
you know, my life at
that
time.
It's a mature record.
Oh, very much.
You know,
yeah.
And we were kids back then.
Hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I was mentally 14 and I'm now mentally 16.
Right.
So I'm
getting
there.
Maybe 15 and a half.
Yeah, 15 and a half. Yeah. Yeah.
I was 20, but we didn't, you know, I taped pretty much everything. And I don't think I taped this to drive around in the car
right.
listen to.
No.
You know
no.
what I mean? It just wasn't something. I mean, we didn't. Unless we're going to go on a killing spree, you know. So,
Nebraska, you were close to Nebraska at this point, right?
I lived in Kansas. Yeah, yeah, I was right above us. Yep.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, people. I think people may know this, but that song's based on a real story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a real person. Yeah. But still, when he takes it to another place, when he, you know, when he says, you know, when they put him on the electric chair, make sure my pretty baby is sitting right there on my lap.
Right.
You know, what I mean, it's like, whoa, dude.
Yeah.
And Johnny 99, which you're going to talk about either.
Yeah.
It's another.
Yeah. I mean, I think he yodels in that one, isn't it? Is that the song where he does like a yodel?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just like.
It's like a psychotic yodel.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a Johnny Cash kind of song.
It really is in that sense. Yeah. Came home too drunk from mixing Tangeray and wine. That's not something you would encourage. Yeah.
It's something. So you mentioned this isn't really necessarily a great driving record. So what is the best setting to listen to Nebraska? How would you.
Well,
I listened to
it last night at about 11:30 after a really sad day, and it was just about right.
bad sports ball for
a long, sad day, couldn't quite get drunk, had a headache, was depressed, and it was about right.
I think, I mean, at home with a glass of whiskey or a beer like this,
yeah.
You know.
It's a whiskey record for sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a gym record. I mean, you know, it's just not going to fit anything you do on the gym. You don't want to jog to it, I don't think.
Oh,
so.
God, no.
No. And I don't think you want to be driving because you might just drive right off the side of the road.
That's right. Exactly right. It actually sold reasonably well.
It went platinum.
The thing. And yeah, and seeing it, it went to number 3 on the Billboard album chart. So
then they played it and put it on the shelf.
But, yeah, exactly right.
Yeah,
a lot of
I think you're
probably
right.
Did.
That was probably
yeah.
it. But I think that mm-hmm. spoke to the power of Springsteen at
yes,
this point,
certainly.
Right? That people
yeah.
were willing. He got a new record out. I got to go out and buy it,
that's
right?
Exactly
I got to hear
what
this is all about.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about the cover art.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
so Sam mentioned it. Describe it a little bit for people.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, Mike, that looks like Kansas or Nebraska
that
to me,
that looks like
man.
The front of
yeah.
my car on many trips through South Dakota, Nebraska, and
yep.
Kansas.
Just totally flat.
It's yeah. just, you could see, it's straight. The horizon line is, you can't see anything in your future.
That's
I mean,
right.
and that's
yeah.
what a lot of these people in this that are in these songs don't see much in your future, so they're just going to do what they do.
Yeah, and on the back, you know, just the titles in big red and black, and then
yeah.
again, there's Bruce, you know, almost looks like The Shining kind of a situation there where you see him around the corner and like a
he's home.
All work and no play. So, yeah, it's quite a stark departure.
Okay.
But I bet you those people that bought that have pulled it out. Just as
oh,
we
yeah,
have,
absolutely.
I mean, if he's done some of these songs in concert, so you
he
kind
has.
Of you go, well, wait a minute, let me give
right.
that a rethink.
He's
right.
he's East Streetified them a little bit.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Some of the songs. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does Johnny 99, and it definitely has it. It's a little more upbeat when he plays
yep.
it live, but not. I don't think he does. You know, there's still only a select few that he'll, I think, pull out.
That's right.
On the live shows,
mm-hmm.
and with probably good reason. Favorite songs? Anyone?
Yeah, I will put a call in for Open All Night. I think it's a great song. It's kind of a Chuck Berry song. I love the image of that eating fried chicken and wiping our fingers on a Texaco roadmap, you know, with my girlfriend sitting on my lap. And he's driving all night. Radio's jammed up with gospel stations. It's a very New Jersey Turnpike kind of a song. So love that tune.
Behind the counter at the Route 60 Bob's Big Boy.
Yes. We've been talking a lot about Johnny 99. I think that was my favorite one off of the album was Johnny 99. And I know this, again, lyrics are disturbing about a guy who goes on basically a killing spree after getting laid off. It's really sad. I don't know about a killing spree, but he kills. Yeah, and but it's a powerful song. And for me, because, you know, the album is just so sad. So it was really hard to listen to. But this was, for me, the easiest out of the bunch.
It is. There is a little bit of lightness in that song.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That makes it a little bit easier. It, despite the subject matter, that somehow he pulls it off, it's not quite as heavy. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's several songs I could pick as favorites now that I've grown up with this album. But, I mean, I think Atlantic City, you know, is the best, you know, overall bigger picture song. And I like that quite a bit.
Well, they blew up a chicken man in Philly last night. Now they blew up his house, too. Down on the boardwalk, they're getting ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble out on the promenade, and the gambling commission's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Well, now everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back. Put your makeup on,
I'm gonna go with Atlantic City. I think it's just a Stone Cold classic song, really can't get enough of that. But I'm also gonna say that if you get a chance, I think this was included on Tracks and probably other places, but I think the version of Born in the USA that was recorded for Nebraska that didn't make it.
Great shout, Jim.
I think it's better than the version on Born in the USA.
Gotcha.
I think just the guitar and vocals and the pacing of the little, it's a little bit, it's not that it's bombastic and sort of heavy as Born in the USA. And I think when you listen to it from these sessions, I think hear more of the intent of the song. I'm sure we'll talk about this tomorrow, but it's a song that got misinterpreted by a lot of people. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is because of how it was produced. And I think if you go back and listen to this, you go like, oh, now I get it. Yeah. That's what the song is supposed to be, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Born down at the Dead Man's Town. The first kick I took was when I hit the ground. Like a dog whispers me too much. Do you spend half your life just to color in a Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. I got in a little hometown jam, and so they put a rifle in my hands. Son, you heard of the Vietnam. Well, go and kill the yellow man. Born in the USA. Born in the USA. Born
Okay. So speaking of which, tomorrow
we're going to Born in the USA.
Yes.
Yeah, man.
So we're going to pick things up a bit here. Get out
I'm
of
looking
our
forward
funk.
To it. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, yeah, we're kind of good. All like everybody's shoulders have kind of sagged if you watch the video.
Yeah, we're gonna blow this yeah. thing
we
out
have
of the
pizza
water.
Here now, so like right. we got that to look forward to. So.
Here we go. All right, let me put in a plug here for our next live event, which is coming up on Tuesday, June 25th. If you are in the DC area, come see us at the O Museum in the Mansion. That is at 2020 O Street. Northwest in Washington, D.C. We're going to start at 6:30 on Tuesday, June 25th. We're going to talk with a guy named Robert Dean Lurie about his book called Begin the Begin, That's R.E.M.'s right. Early Years. That's going to be a lot of fun. And this is a free event, but you need to reserve your space. So go to suburbspod.com. We'll have a link there for where you can do that. And we hope to see you there for that. Yeah. That'll be a lot of fun.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Really looking forward to it.
Come on out and see us. We'll talk with Robert about REM, and we'll also record all of that for the podcast, and you'll have a chance to ask questions yourself. So,
and it's free.
So do that. And it's free. It's going to be a great time. Please listen to the show once in a while.
Every day.
Every day.
You can find us on all the big podcast platforms. We also love to hear from you. You can email us, rock@suburbspod.com, talk about Springsteen, Nebraska, what have you. You can also call and leave a message, and we'll put your voice on an upcoming show, 612-440-1984. Or find us on the social medias of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at Suburbs Pod. All right, guys, I'm excited. Tomorrow is the epic conclusion of Springsteen Week.
Oh, yes.
Friday.
With,
and then a new era of Springsteen begins.
That's right.
In the same new, day we talk right. about the old.
New right. album's coming out tomorrow. It's going to be great.
That's right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
I'm Sam Lusker.
I'm Mike Schneider.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Midnight in prison storeroom. Leather straps across my chest. Sheriff, when the man pulls that switcher and snaps my poor head back, you make sure my pretty baby sitting right there on my lap.
I've been working on a kids book. I took my growler to the brewery.
Yeah, it's called. Yeah.